This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Now your host, Roger Waldron.
Today, my guests on Off the Shelf are Chris Payne. He's a senior economic analyst with Bloomberg Government, and Cameron Luthy. Cameron, who's been on the show before, previously, is a senior budget analyst with Bloomberg. Guys, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Great to be here, Roger.
Well, I'm looking forward to this discussion. It's what someone described it as, shutdown fever. I mean, it's shut down all the time, and trying to address or talk about the and put into context where we are with regard to and where we've been with regard to, you know, these negotiations, the shutdown, and what the ramifications, big picture, are. And so, Cameron, I want to sort of start with you. Can you talk a little bit about, the history of this whole, crazy process? And I'm being polite. And how we as a nation and government got to where we are?
Well, it is complicated, but I'll try and break it down and keep it simple. When the last time we were flirting with the debt ceiling in 2011, there was a political deal which said, let's do something about deficits. So on the one hand, we were dealing with the debt ceiling, which is the limit on borrowing for bills you've already incurred. But the compromise involved future spending as well, trying to limit it. So there were multiple parts. The first phase was a reduction of about $900 billion over 10 years in discretionary spending. Phase two was a super committee of Congress that was supposed to come up with $1.2 trillion in additional deficit reduction, which could come from A, cutting entitlements, B, increasing revenues, or C, more cuts to discretionary spending.
Yeah.
Well, guess what? The super committee wasn't so super, and the law said if you fail, and they failed, $1.2 trillion in additional cuts to discretionary spending through lower caps and sequestration in 2013. So that was how we got here. They raised the debt ceiling, and then they raised it again in January. Well, what they did really was they suspended it through May. So there was, in essence, no ceiling on borrowing through May. So that's where the clock started ticking again in mid-May on the debt ceiling. And on the spending side, the House and Senate had completely different ideas on how to adhere to the spending caps that were set back in 2011 and adjusted since then. And the Senate said, we don't like the caps, and we'd offset it by entitlement cuts and revenue increases. And the House said, well, we're going to stick to the cap on the non-defense side, but we're going to ignore it on the defense side. So they're all over the map. It's crazy city when it comes to actual spending bills. The House passed 4, the Senate passed 0, and the numbers are way apart on some of those bills. So that's sort of the spending side. And in some ways, in this giant mess, this toxic stew of political animosity, the spending bills are the tail. The dog is debt ceiling and deficit reduction macro sense. You know, what do we do about entitlements and revenues? So in
some sense,
it's not fair to the appropriations process to say, why didn't you get your bills done? They had completely different number targets. Because remember, the House and Senate each passed their own budget resolutions, but they never sat down to come together and work out the differences.
And so, is it a matter of, enough with continuing resolutions, so let's have a fight about it? Is that sort of what happened at the end of the day here?
You know, the continuing resolution that passed the House and Senate was pretty much a clean CR, few adjustments, would have frozen spending at the 13 levels, which would have left defense over the caps by almost $20 billion and non-defense under. Would have been fine, except that it got weighted down with other issues, no kidding, Obamacare.
Right, right.
Yeah. And I think what Cameron has told us is obviously a sort of a short-term story of how he got here. But of course, why did he get weighted down with bigger issues? We really have to tell a much longer story about political theory. And I know it's a strange thing to maybe be sat on the radio talking about political theory, but we obviously do have two sides with totally different opposing visions of the future of this country. And one side, the Tea Party side, is enamored with the works of people like Ayn Rand or Friedrich Hayek and believe that more government and Obamacare is the road to serfdom. I mean, we've heard Grove from Norquist actually talk, his favorite author, his favorite book is The Road to Serfdom, written in 1944, a warning from this philosopher economist Hayek that more government can only lead to more government and more government and a destruction of everyone's wealth. And honestly, it sounds grand, maybe it sounds crazy, but that's really why we're here. You know, we have these small battles along the way, but we really, the interesting thing about now is there's not a lot left, not a lot of room for compromise left. I mean, we've really hit the wall of a battle with two sides with completely contrasting visions of perhaps the United States.
Right. And you know, a good example of that, Chris, is the transportation appropriations bill. You know, Roger, we've talked about that, where both the House and the Senate had bills that they were going to bring to the floor, and at the last minute they had to pull them because they didn't think they had the votes to pass them. There's used to be House Democrats, House Republicans, Senate, both sides. They all agreed spending money on transportation was a good thing.
Good thing, yes.
Right? Yeah, right. Now it's not quite so clear because the gas tax doesn't pay for enough of the projects. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, then the question is, should we be using general funds to do that? And it raised some legitimate questions like, you know, really, is it the federal government built the interstate system? Why do we have to keep putting money into it? Why can't the states pave it when it needs repaving?
Well, yeah, and that's, I mean, and I guess maybe even things like the Bridge to Nowhere, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
That's a bad sort of a picture for people to think about, especially from the Tea Party side, right?
I mean,
they look at things like that.
And when you tell people we have to cut things that they care about, they immediately think about things like the Bridge to Nowhere.
Right, right.
And, you know, everybody's got their own sacred cow. They don't want to cut my program, cut that other guy's program,
well,
but...
Well, there's a belief among some that government spending literally detracts value from the private sector. And by virtue of lessening the size of the government, you leave room for the private sector to grow. And I mean, obviously, we all believe in the private sector. I mean, that's where our entrepreneurs, that's where
wealth is
creativity
right.
and wealth is generated. There's no one saying that. But there's obviously other, you know, some people believe that, well, we also need an interstate system that works and that isn't crowded and that you can drive on the I-95 without hitting 2-hour traffic jams every time you want to go up and down the East Coast.
And unicorns and rainbows.
Well, yeah, and it's just, to me, it's kind of interesting, too, and you talk about sort of that looking at political philosophy and what it all means. Well, there's no better place to do that than Washington, D.C., right? Or
putting theory into practice.
Or not, or like the practices you don't want to preach. But, you know, I guess one of the things that I'm sort of finding interesting is, you know, that's been reported over the last few days, and I just get your thoughts on it, is, you know, you mentioned the Tea Party, Chris, and that's, you know, a subset or a faction within the Republican Party. But there seems to, you see more and more, you know, comments about sort of mainstream Republicans or business, which has been tied to the Republican Party for generations, and a focus on low taxes, less government, less regulation that to promote growth. But you know, the Tea Party, that faction of the party, you know, in terms of, you know, debt ceiling sort of deniers, I'll put that in quotes, that people they're described as, that seems to have created a lot of tension between the business community and, you know, and the Republican Party.
Well, I mean, of course, ultimately the business community are looking at their revenues and their profits, and they need to, well, they need to sell contracts and if they sell to the government. But they don't, you know, sometimes they want the government to help. I mean, they're not.
You're right, sure.
The interesting thing about business is it's corporatist, right? And the Tea Party is not corporatist. I mean, the Tea Party essentially are libertarians who believe, who devoutly believe in the benefits of competition. And I mean, the idea actually for a Tea Party, for a paid up member of the Tea Party, of sort of government in bed with business, trying to sort of, you know, relax, do something that, you know, give them contracts, you know, favoured buyers, that favoured buyer status, this kind of thing, protect them from competition, is actually anathema for them. So there is a fundamental... Tea Party Republicans are libertarians in that sense, when they believe that the government's role is actually, where there isn't competition, to create competition, to create markets that can force people to compete. So actually, there's nothing to necessarily say that business and business interests will always align with the Tea Party. In fact, you know, if your role is this year's profits, this year's sales, actually, you as a businessman, what does a business want? It wants less competition sometimes. So there's nothing necessarily that bring the two. I mean, yes, of course, both sides want less taxes, right?
Sure.
Both sides want less regulation, but actually you find that businesses maybe want help from the government to sell abroad, to stop competition, anti-dumping measures, when in fact they're not anti-dumping measures, but, you know, the Chinese just have much cheaper labor costs.
Sure.
Right?
But
we, so it's a different, they're not necessarily the same thing.
Right, and Chris, right now we have to do some business, so we'll be taking a break, but when we come back, we'll be talking more to Chris Payne. He is a senior economic analyst at Bloomberg, and Cameron Luthy, who is a senior budget analyst at Bloomberg. And when we come back, I'm going to ask Chris, what is the debt ceiling? Can he explain this whole concept to us? You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
In the ever-changing national security and IT environments, L3 delivers innovative, cost-effective solutions. As a Fortune 200 company, L3 offers customers global end-to-end services and solutions for large-scale systems. No matter the challenge, L3 has the agility, technology, and innovation required for mission performance. From cybersecurity to next-generation IT, L3's passion for its customers' missions drives its commitment to excellence. L3. Agility, innovation, performance.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guests are Chris Payne, who's a senior economic analyst with Bloomberg Government, and Cameron Luthy, who is also a senior budget analyst at Bloomberg Government. And hey, maybe, guys, I'll ask you first. My first question, I've been wanting to ask it since, what's the difference between an economic analyst and a budget analyst? Okay. Tell me that, guys.
Well,
without insulting each other, okay?
I'm gonna take a run at it. So I'm a budget analyst because I don't have a degree in economics. So we used to say I'm not an economist, but I play one at OMB.
Oh, okay.
That's where I got my training and hung out with a lot of economists, and some of it rubbed off, but only a bit.
Okay. Anything to add there, Chris?
No, you know, I just, like all practitioners of the dismal science, I just talk generally, you know, in platitudes. And
on the one hand.
Sure,
on the other hand.
On the other hand. On
have
this
you,
hand,
have
on
you
the
got
other
enough
hand.
Hands?
Right.
Yes.
Right. So, as a lawyer, that's what, you know, that's what I was trained to do as well. So, So Chris, you know, when we took the break, I mentioned the debt ceiling. So, I want to give you, you know, airtime here to talk what the heck is the debt ceiling, and why does it matter?
Well, the debt ceiling is the most bizarre thing, I think. And I should say, I mean, I'm a naturalized American, but perhaps you can tell that I'm not originally from this
no,
country.
No, not really. Okay.
maybe you tell, maybe not. So, you know, I have a slight outsider's perspective, and from that perspective, I can tell you that there is no other country, as far as I'm aware of, that has a debt ceiling, that has a limit on the dollar amount that the US government can borrow at any one time. And it's a very strange thing. I mean, that's essentially what the debt ceiling is. Congress says we can only borrow $16.7 trillion. And if we hit that limit, well, we have to stop borrowing. And at that precise second in time, therefore, anything we spend has to be matched by revenues we've already received. Even if it's only a timing matter between revenues and spending, finish, enough. We cannot borrow more than this. As I said, and that 16.7 trillion, that's obviously the debt ceiling. We're going to be hitting it supposedly on October the 17th. No one actually knows, but this is the this is the estimate. It's a very strange thing to have a limit on this.
Sometimes I'm thinking about my credit cards, right? You got a limit on those, right?
Yes, I'm pleased that you raised that, because say you weren't $50,000 a year, would you expect your limit to be the same as if you weren't $1 million a year?
Oh, absolutely not. No.
Correct. So what you can borrow is always and ever a reflection of how much you earn, right?
Right.
It's very, you know, in financial theory, okay, if you have a company that has strong earnings, has and needs money to make investments to increase that are going to be profitable, that are going to increase the value of the company, they would be crucified by their shareholders for not borrowing more. Okay.
Right.
What the only thing that matters, and over the last few weeks I've heard what I can only describe as drivel about people saying, you know, we got to stop borrowing. We can't borrow anymore. It would be crazy for an economy that has the history of enterprise and creativity that the US economy has to say you can't borrow anymore. It's only relevant. The $16 trillion has only one relevance. It's in relation to what GDP is now. The amount of debt outstanding only matters in relation to gross domestic product, right? You know, if your gross domestic product, you can have 60% debt to GDP, 70% debt to GDP. There is no evidence that these are unhealthy levels of debt to GDP. In fact, they're healthy if actually that debt is being used for value-added matters. Right. Now, that's a different argument, and we can talk about that this time or another time. But the notion that you should say that there is some finite limit that is irrelevant to the amount of wealth that you're generating makes absolutely no sense. So, I mean, if there was any sense at all, the notion that there is a debt ceiling should be done away with. I mean, it's just ridiculous. Obviously, there needs to be...
How do you really feel?
Right. But obviously, there are limits to what debt to GDP should be. And we've seen with Greece, we've seen with Italy,
sure. Mm-hmm.
That investors start getting a bit worried if debt to GDP hits 100%, right? And they start getting very worried if then growth, the denominator of that equation, starts to slow down, right?
Sure.
And that's very genuine. That's a correct concern to have, as we've seen. And that's a sensible, very sensible discussion. And we need to think about long-term entitlement programs. We'll perhaps talk about
that
later.
Yeah, we'll talk about it in a bit.
But when it comes to the debt ceiling, it's really ridiculous.
Okay. So one thing I wanted to ask you, too, about is, so does the world really end if that debt ceiling isn't raised?
I mean, it depends how it really depends for how long. I mean, if the US government essentially can't pay, I mean, we have a deficit, okay? And for that reason, if the US government can't pay its interest bills, it can't repay, for whatever reason, there's one particular bond that needs to be repaid that's coming to the end of its life, and
right.
It needs to be maturing, it needs to be rolled over, and that can't be done, and the US defaults, then if that really were to be happen, then that would cause financial maelstrom. I mean, there's an interbank. When Lehman Brothers failed, it could be a Lehman Brothers event, in the sense that many financial institutions fund themselves using treasury bonds as collateral in what's called the repo market, to borrow from other financial institutions and other large corporations and buyers in that market. It's a 1. I think it's numbers are difficult, but there may be $1.6 trillion worth of lending in interbank markets funded, collateralized with US treasuries. Now, obviously, if people were suddenly going to require much more collateral for the same amount of borrowing in the form of US treasuries, then that's essentially a run. That's what happened after Lehman Brothers. And there could be a financial meltdown. I mean, you know, the chances of that being allowed to happen are clearly very, very small. If you think about what happened when TARP wasn't passed and the stock market collapsed 7%, you know, people wake up very quickly when they realize the effects of not doing something. So obviously it could be a financial meltdown, but I it's very unlikely. I don't think there'll ever be a debt ceiling crisis that really comes to that. And I think that's what the markets are saying. You know, you've had a little bit of jittery, little bit of jittery noise from investors in the last couple of weeks, bond market investors, stock market investors all over the place all the time. Don't worry about them. But in terms of the bond market, you've had some concerns, but no investor believes that we're really going to walk over this suicidal cliff.
Right. So, but there's ramifications. It's kind of interesting listening to you as I started thinking about this. And it's like, you know, that no other country has this debt ceiling that we, you know, that we do. It's unique to us. But it's almost like a self-inflicted wound from the perspective of, you know, you hear, you know, the credit rating, you know, like Standard & Poor's, whoever, you know, the credit rating organization saying, hey, you know, the mere fact that you're debating this is potentially impacting your credit rating, you know, the American government's credit rating. And, you know, and it has, right, been lowered in one instance?
Yeah, it was lowered. It was lowered last year.
In 2011. It
specifically due to their comments on the failings of the political system.
Right. Not because we actually defaulted, not because we, you know, but because we dithered so much that it made the raters
nervous,
uncomfortable. And that has long-term potential impacts on the cost of borrowing. And you know, as Chris correctly pointed out, we're running deficits and, you know, we have to borrow about, you know, a third of what we need to cover the bills each year. And if the long-term cost of borrowing goes up, that adds to, you know, the debt service, which is
almost
one
like
of the bills
vicious
we have
cycle,
to pay.
Right?
And,
yeah.
And everything that we as consumers, households, businesses borrow is essentially priced off U.S. Treasuries. So if the government is paying more to borrow, then we're all going to end up paying more to borrow. And that obviously adds sort of the headwinds to it, makes it economic growth just that little bit more difficult.
And it's particularly ironic in that, you know, the Fed has been doing what it can to keep interest rates down using tools like quantitative easing to increase the money supply. Because the economy is weak, they want people to buy houses, to buy cars, to buy refrigerators. And yet the action of the Congress right now is causing a potential.
Well, that's actually true. And when it comes to the stock market, definitely, you know, the Fed, when the Fed creates money, buys bonds, a lot of the people who sell the bonds to the Fed are then going to put it into other assets like the stock market.
Sure.
So it's a deliberate attempt to create wealth through asset prices, and the stock market is an important part of that. So this debate, you know, it's an exact opposite of it's fighting against what another part of the government, the Federal Reserve, are doing in order to get wealth and get confidence and that kind of, you know.
Increase business activity.
Exactly.
Right. It's business activity. We have to take our break, right? So when we come back, we'll be talking more to Cameron Lutherty. He is a senior budget analyst at Bloomberg Government. And Chris Payne, he is a senior economic analyst at Bloomberg Government. And you are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Rise above. Lead the charge. Take control. If you work in defense, you live these goals day in and day out. Turn to Deloitte. With our private sector insight and public sector experience, we'll help you deliver more defense with fewer dollars so that the DoD can dominate the business of defense. See how at Deloitte.com/federal. Wherever you need to go, Deloitte sees you there.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guests are Cameron Luthy. He's a senior budget analyst at Bloomberg Government, and Chris Payne, who is a senior economic analyst at Bloomberg Government. And guys, when we took the break, we had done a deep dive, or to the extent you can, on the debt ceiling and what it all means, and what the impact of where we are with regard to the government versus the Federal Reserve. You touched on that a little bit. But I want to get back to a little bit to, you know, on the ground sort of stuff and contracting. So, you know, Cameron, I'm going to turn to you and ask you to give, you know, your insights as to what's sort of going on with the budget vis-a-vis contractors right now. You know, there's been a lot of discussion over the past week and where folks were furloughed. You know, can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, the shutdown has gone on longer than I would have anticipated that I thought it would.
I think you're with everybody there.
If you'd asked me,
Chris doesn't agree with that.
There's no compromise. That's true.
Political context that Chris so aptly described is in fact the reality. I tell people, look, it took us a long time to get to this level of dysfunctionality in the political process, and it's not going to change overnight. It's going to take time, and we have to find some little things that all sides can agree to in order to sort of rebuild some trust. And unfortunately, that hasn't happened yet. There were things I thought we could do this year, like the Farm Bill, like the reauthorization of the Corps of Engineers, where there was a lot of common ground. Didn't happen.
Yeah, yeah.
So the shutdown has had, it's been longer than I thought it would be, and it's had tremendous impact on federal contractors. And it's interesting the way that impact is felt by different types of companies.
Sure. Let's talk about that a little bit.
So let's say that you're selling a commodity like fuel to the government. Well, it really doesn't matter so much if the government shut down, because you can always sell it once the government reopens.
Right.
But if you're selling a service, it depends. We always use that phrase. It depends on what it is you're selling.
You sound like an economist.
Yeah, I know. So if you're selling staff augmentation services to an intelligence agency where you have a whole bunch of contractors who are sitting side by side with government employees, and those government employees have been furloughed, your guys can't go to work, which means every day that the government's shut, you're losing revenue.
Right.
On the other hand, there I go, like an economist.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say that the government contracted with you to write a report, do an analysis. Well, you can keep doing that. You weren't going to get the money all up front anyway. You'll get paid when the report is done. It's a deliverable. Let's say that we all know.
Well, let me just talk. The old issue, like when I was in government as an attorney, it's, you know, recurring services versus a single undertaking. That's what you've just sort of described there. And it's a single undertaking is a, you know, from a service perspective, is a product that's produced, whether it's a report, you know, a piece of software or whatever. And you can be made whole for that. For recurring things like theoretically trash pickup or, you know, a service like that, that you're paid for actually, you know, coming in and doing that each time. And when that goes away, you're right. That's a loss of revenue, and presumably you got to pay those employees because you want to keep your, you know, that's your job. That's your, those are your core. That's who you're earners. That's who you are, right?
Right.
Sure.
And some companies have more flexibility to keep those people. They've got cash reserves. They can sort of put them on the beach, have them do administrative things. Other companies, smaller companies, may not have the cash. They may not be able to sustain. They may have to let people go. And that's just terrible when you lose your best asset, which is your people. You know, there are all different scenarios. Some companies, for example, signed contracts late in September.
In
the fiscal year, government signs a lot of contracts. Depending on the nature of that contract, that work may be able to be executed or it may not, in part because it requires, if the contract requires a government employee to be supervising the work, and that government employee's been furloughed,
you're out of business. You know, last week we heard a lot of that where, like, I think it was Sikorsky, right? They were going to, you know, slow down or furlough folks because the inspectors weren't going to be on site, right?
Yep.
And I think some of the other companies are the same in the defense market.
Right,
were
where
the,
they
the
can't,
thing.
They get paid when they deliver.
Right, and part of delivery
deliver
is inspection, right?
Until there's an inspection and the inspector's gone home.
Right, and then DOD called back like 400,000 folks, I think, that's what I recall. Yeah. So
they got their sort of get out of jail card.
Right. So, you know, from an economic perspective, Chris, that, you know, slowdown in contracting and, you know, that the idea that it's really is hit or miss across the federal market. You know, what's the impact there when you think of it? What's the ripple impact of that?
Well, I mean, I think I'm right in saying that in past shutdowns, essentially, it hasn't had a long effect at all. I mean, it things pick up. I mean, everyone's still being paid. It's a huge, giant waste of money. I mean, from a federal government perspective, when you furlough 700,000 people and you pay them and they're, you know, sitting at home doing nothing, I mean, what a waste is that?
Right.
But arguably that. I would suspect that the long-term impact, the long-term impact of a shutdown that, you know, we hope is going to be relatively short, is very little. I mean, people get back to work, they have to catch up with what they've missed. Contracts are still there. What they do goes on. People, you know, they're still spending. If you're being paid, you're still spending. So I think it's the economic impact is frankly not of the shutdown. I don't think it's something that we should really be worried about yet. You know, the economic impact of going of not raising the debt ceiling is that much more immediate, that much greater. I think a lot of people use the word uncertainty. I mean, this is like the economic word of the age, isn't it?
Yeah, well, absolutely.
You know, uncertainty. Yeah. You know, people are worried about Obamacare because it creates uncertainty for businesses planning for the future and how much they're going to pay their staff, et cetera, et cetera. People, that's a modern use of the word, more modern use of the word uncertainty. In the old days, someone like John Maynard Keynes would have used the term uncertainty in the sense that we just don't know if people are going to. I can't plan as a business because I don't know what my sales are going to be because I'm unsure whether consumers are going to spend or not.
Right.
So that's a different sense, and I mean, obviously that both, you know, there's a sense. Well, uncertainty as things go on, will people stop spending? You know, will people because they're unsure. Does dysfunctional government mean that people become more uncertain about the future? It may do, but it's a long, it takes a long, long time, I would suspect, for people to really think that American government is so dysfunctional that it will go over the debt ceiling. I mean, all of these things can be overplayed.
You're talking about the, to me, right, the psychological aspect of economics,
consumer confidence,
right?
Yeah, business.
But it's more than, you know, it's seeing what your sales are. I mean, business is all about forecasting what they think their sales are, and if they see them going down now, well, most people connect the dots and think they're going to go not be as great as they had previously thought.
Well, yeah, and I guess I want to follow up that. So in the current, you know, state of play, or when you think about uncertainty, does the fact that we're still sort of on recovering from the Great Recession, does that undercurrent or that foundation of people's mindset, is it easier to trigger their unease and like I'm going to pull back?
I would guess that has to be true. I mean,
it's sort of a recency phenomenon,
right? I mean, so that's absolutely true. But I mean, one other thing that we should mention here is one can talk about the psychological aspects, but one should also definitely talk about interest rates. I mean, if there's one thing, if there's one, what an economist would say, transmission mechanism, that's a horrible term, that's really hits people in their, you know, in their wallet.
Immediately,
right, yeah. It's interest rates. And we talked about S&P downgrading US debt. I mean, there is, over time, if we have more and more and more of these kind of battles, then there will come a point where we'll say, well, you know, it AA+. Okay, so we were AAA, AA+, then there's AA, AA-. AA+ does not mean, which is what S&P downgraded us to, I think, if I remember correctly, that still means you're a very safe and sound investment if you're a buyer of debt. Does not mean you're anywhere but very safe and sound. Okay.
Right.
People
but,
all over the world invest in US Treasury.
And it's still the risk-free, whatever S&P say, and you know, let's not overplay the value of credit rating agencies. I think they showed us how valuable they were during the lead up to the financial crisis.
Yeah.
But you know, there comes a point, well, you know, you just what you're paying on 5-year treasuries is just that little bit more relative to what AAA or what you would have done without this kind of political dysfunction. And over the long period of time, you know, that
will add up, right?
It adds up, and people have to pay a bit more for credit. And, you know, regardless of what some people think about credit, you know, credit is an essential part of the way that everyone in our modern economy goes about planning their cash flows or making investments. And so it is important.
Right. And right now we have to take our last break. But when we come back, we'll be talking more to Chris Payne. He's a senior economic analyst at Bloomberg Government, and Cameron Luthy, who is a senior budget analyst at Bloomberg Government. And you are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
The mission of government involves critical efforts to improve national defense, economic security, health services, and citizens' lives. The strategy and technology consultants of Booz Allen Hamilton are proud to help government address cyber threats, reform the financial system, modernize infrastructure, and protect our nation. For nearly 100 years, Booz Allen has partnered with clients to deliver results that endure. To see Booz Allen's ideas in action, visit BoozAllen.com.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guests are Cameron Luthy. He is a senior budget analyst at Bloomberg Government, and Chris Payne, who is a senior economic analyst at Bloomberg Government. And last segment. First, I wanted to ask you, Cameron, can you talk a little bit about like what you crystal ball says about full year appropriations, moving forward?
So the government will reopen. The government will reopen under a continuing resolution, which will probably be relatively short in nature. I can't bet the farm on it, but that's the way I think these things usually resolve themselves, at which time they will have to come to agreement. The House and Senate marks, as I mentioned at the outset in the first segment, was they're far apart. So they're going to get a number. And they're going to be told, this is the total for defense. This is the total for everything else. You got to hit that number, make it fit, fit the size 10 foot into the size 9 mm-hmm. shoe. And they'll have to make some tough choices. If I had to bet, I would say that there will be full year line by line appropriations for some agencies, but not all. Very similar to this year, this past year, 13. 14 will follow that pattern more than likely, partly because they just don't have time. So there will be some agencies, like this year we had a whole handful, agriculture, commerce, justice, NASA, NIST, DHS, Department of Defense, and VA all got line-by-line appropriations. The rest of the government was on a full-year CR, but there were exceptions even there where they would pluck out one agency or one account and say,
okay, mm-hmm.
you get really, this yeah. amount, more or less than the previous year. So that's what I think the way it'll resolve. And I think the top-line numbers will probably be closer to the spending caps in law than the higher numbers that the Senate and the president's budget had in them, because to do otherwise means you're increasing the deficit.
Sure.
And mm-hmm. then what's the offset? And if the House Republicans refuse to embrace any more tax increases, then you've got to go after entitlements. And what's the trade space? The president put $300 billion of cuts to Medicare on the table, but is he willing to trade that for a little bit more money for defense and non-defense? I'm not sure.
Interesting. And, it seems to me, when I think about this thing, I think about that movie Groundhog Day and Bill Murray, right? And it's like, he gets up and repeats the same day over and over until he becomes a good person. I will say that.
Yes.
So when is our government going to, quote, become a good person? And, how does this all play out? And I guess, Chris, I would ask you to sort of give some context to where we have come in terms of, you talked earlier segment about the debt and how much it is and what you think, how this would get solved. What's Chris Payne's idea?
I think that there's long-term budget problems. And so at the moment, this year, I think debt to GDP, it's a publicly traded debt to GDP, is going to be about 73%. Okay.
Okay.
And that historically, obviously, is high. Before the crisis, before the financial crisis, we were around, I think we're just under 40%, something like 38%. So it's gone up. It's very important to say that the reason it's gone up is because what happens in a recession is that revenues go down. And in fact, revenues fell from, I think, somewhere in the region of 18-19% of GDP to 15% of GDP.
Yeah, okay. That's a huge
drop. So the deficit appeared because revenues fell and the government continued fundamentally to spend at the same kind of levels it was before. The notion that there was, so this is automatic, right? It's what it's what governments do. And of course, some costs go up, like unemployment insurance. So to put that aside, we are at this situation with 73% where to go much higher, to not have a plan to keep us at this level and slowly bring us down. I mean, ideally, you want to bring the US debt to GDP down, because when the next recession hits, you want to have room for the government to continue spending on certain unemployment insurance.
That's
the
margin for error kind of
exactly.
thing, right?
Exactly.
You're saying that the business cycle hasn't disappeared?
If only, you know, if only. But that's the point. So you clearly want to get it down. And there are some long-term issues. And I think most people are aware, the CBO, is Congressional Budget Office, is always looking at what happens to healthcare costs and Social Security costs from kind of the mid-2020s on. Now, again, we come back to the dismal science, and forecasting next week is bad enough. Forecasting 10 years, 20 years' time is in many ways ridiculous. And of course, it gets obfuscated by people saying, yes, but healthcare, the growth of healthcare costs has slowed in the last 3 years. So therefore, we should draw the line from the last 3 years, not right. the years before that. I don't know. I do know that pretty much a large amount of OECD countries, I can certainly think of Germany and the UK as two examples, have put, for instance, the age of retirement up. I mean, that is something that in an aging population, when Social Security came into law in the 60s, I think the average life expectancy of an American male was 68 years. Okay, so you were talking about 3 years of retirement. Mm-hmm. Okay, what is the average expectancy now? 78, I think, 77, yeah. 78. Yeah. Yeah. The world has changed, and we can't... I think people, Democrats maybe, who want to defend the system as it is, just have to accept the reality that you're going to have to save a lot of money by putting the age of retirement up. And that should be brought into some grand bargain. That's quite obvious. Right. I mean, the same... And, of course, the same
that's
goes...
That's just precedent for that, because they raised it once before. Like,
right.
You know what I mean? I my retirement age is not 65. My full retirement's like 66 or 67, something. I can't remember what the formula is. But
it's going to have to go up. There's going to have to be some kind of control of healthcare costs. I'm no expert in health economics and... Goodness, oh, thank God. Yeah. But it's, you know, things will have to be done. And on the tax side, the revenue side, I mean, the tax code is a complete mess. And the corporate tax, people talk about the US having the highest rate of corporation tax, but who pays that?
Nobody.
No one pays that. Let's look at the effective tax rates that are all over the place, depending on who you
what
are.
What sector.
And of course, this is something that should appeal to Tea Party people who don't think that it's the government's business to have an industrial policy that favors one sector over another through tax breaks. And of course, there's individual income tax breaks like mortgage interest tax relief, which again is, you know, the government should not be in the business of giving homeowners a tax incentive over those who choose to rent. I mean, that is...
wait a second now.
No, of course, no one's allowed to say it because you'd lose vote. But really, it is not... If we talk about what might appeal to a Tea Party member, it's saying, no, it is not the government's business to encourage homeownership.
Let's look
what happened when we did in the Clinton-Bush eras.
There are some areas from a practical standpoint. Let's just say, for the sake of argument, that I want to keep the home interest mortgage deduction, but would I be willing to accept a threshold? If the house is worth over $600,000, maybe that deduction doesn't happen.
Right.
Similarly, on Social Security, I might argue with Chris about raising the age or maybe having some sort of multiple paths, forks in the road. If you're a manual laborer, it's hard to keep working at 68. If you work at a desk like I do, it's a little easier. But there are all kinds of other ways that you can help, which is including, for example, the cap on Social Security taxing earnings is what, $110,000?
Yeah. Yeah.
I think there are a number of people who make more than that, and I'd be fine with taxing all of that income.
One thing I should say, I mean, a lot has actually been done, and I think that's kind of forgotten in these political battles. It wasn't so long ago, you know, we were fought the CBO's baseline, you know, was, well, adjusted baseline, because no one believed that all the Bush-era tax cuts were going to be rolled over. That gets complicated, but people were talking about 90-100% debt to GDP within a few years. So actually, a lot has been done.
Oh, yeah.
And we have stabilized. Things are essentially stable as they are.
Right.
But there are, you know, the worst thing we can do, we talk about what this generation of politicians needs to do for the next generation of Americans, is not, we need to stop borrowing from our future, from our children, which Absolutely. Is essentially what you we're know, doing.
And Chris, on that note, and that's a great message, we've got to end the show, but so I want to thank my guest today, Chris Payne, who is a senior economic analyst at Bloomberg Government, and Cameron Luthy, who is a senior budget analyst at Bloomberg Government. And thank you guys. Great conversation. And you have been listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.